Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The Vietnam War, it's over.
Your job's just begun.
A new HBO original limited series.
Welcome to the world of spycraft.
Strap in.
From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr.
What are you concealing?
Based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Viet Thanh Nguyen.
What if I told you that I was a communist spy?
How did you become this?
The Sympathizer, streaming April 14th on Max. Subscription required.
Hey, Geekscapists, welcome to a brand new Geekscape podcast. I'm Jonathan London. That'd be your host. And if this is your first Geekscape, well, we talk movies, video games, comic books, pop culture, all that stuff that we love. I mean, when we started this show in 2005, I don't think this was at the popularity that it is now with the comic book movies and the 17 Batman movies and the Comic Cons and the Marvel Universe. But we've been here for 15 years. We've seen it grow with us, and I really appreciate y'all checking out every week. But if this is your first, well, welcome. That's what we do. We talk pop culture, and I've got a great show for y'all today. My good buddy Rob Schroeder, who I've known for almost 20 years, has a brand new movie coming out called Ultrasound. It hits VOD on March 11th. That's Jonathan, get your days straight. And Connor Stickschulte. I think I got that name right. It's based on a comic book that he put out. I call it a comic book. It's actually a series of graphic novels because it's just not the 22-page graphic novel norm. But that one's called, let me see. I got the graphic novel here. I did read a lot of it. And it's called Generous Bosom. And the movie's not called Generous Bosom. The movie is called Ultrasound. It comes out on the 11th. And we're going to talk about it, adapting the comic. I'm going to keep saying comic. I'm so sorry. The graphic novel series into film, putting it together during a pandemic, finishing it during a pandemic, premiering at Tribeca. And really, like, we're going to talk to two creatives of the visual arts here on Geekscape because it's what we do. Remember, like, we're one of the top shows in film interviews here on the podcast landscape. And I appreciate you making us one of the podcasts that you listen to every week. We got some great shows coming up. I know that we're going to have that Batman review of the new Robert Pattinson Batman coming up. So you want to subscribe to the podcast and share it with your friends. Okay. We've been doing really great. Best numbers we've ever done. So I really appreciate all the word of mouth. Okay. Let's enough with the hemming and hawing. I think enough of y'all are listening. Let's get the show started. All right, Geekscape, let's get to it. The movie's called Ultrasound. It comes out March 11th on VOD. Let's see who's in this movie, okay? I did watch it. I watched it today. It's got Vincent Kartheiser. You know him from Mad Men. Who else has it got? Chelsea Lopez. Oh, I think Breida Wool. I think you last saw her on, like, Mr. Mercedes, if you watched that show. That's like a Stephen King-involved show, so I'm guessing some of y'all at least watched it. Rainey Qualley, who I found out was Andy McDowell's daughter. Remember Andy McDowell? I love Andy McDowell. Come on. Greystoke? Come on. Did you not know? Like, who hasn't seen Greystoke? Razor. You know what I'm talking about. Geekscapists. You're a little older Geekscapists would know about Greystoke. That's one of my favorite Tarzan films. But let's get to it. The movie's called Ultrasound. It's a little bit of a mind-bendy journey. Let's see the comments. Dan Gilbert over there in Texas goes, let's go commute. Listen, he's in Texas commuting. Joey Kochik on YouTube says, holy shit, I'm actually watching live, dude. I appreciate it. Joey, where are you watching from? I know you moved out of LA. And then Mr. Jason Elliott, who I believe is in Houston, is actually watching on LinkedIn. He's probably dropping those resumes and watching Geekscape at the same time. It's crazy. I've started streaming this thing on LinkedIn, and it actually has a per capita reaction larger than any of the other platforms, including Twitch, YouTube, and Facebook. So LinkedIn is where it's at. But there's Jason Elliott saying, how are you, Mr. JL? I have a feeling that Jason and I might talk in the next 2 days because my Utah Jazz are visiting his Houston Rockets. And that is a different podcast. That's a sports podcast. We don't have that on the network, but we do have like 20 other shows on the network, ranging from like pro wrestling to music to horror movies, female filmmaking to comedy to all sorts of stuff. And the person in charge of running the network is right here. His name is Matt Kelly. And he says, I'm so excited for this. Well, good. I'm glad. I like having creative talks with creative people. And Joey's now with his dog Crypto. I'm guessing he's a Superman fan. He lives in north of Boston now, so that's cool. And Garrett Briones on YouTube says, hey, plug that Garrettscape. Y'all who are watching on YouTube, definitely subscribe, because Garrett's got a pretty cool video starting out that's hitting the network tomorrow over on youtube.com/GeekscapeTV. It's all about that first season of Netflix's Daredevil and why it, I think in his argument, is the best Marvel like film or TV adaptation ever. You know, I love it. I do love that first season of Daredevil. I like the first couple. All right, we got a lot of stuff to talk about, so let me get right to the filmmakers. Here's Rob Schroeder, who I've known for almost 20 years. He's the director of Ultrasound. Hey, Rob, how are you, brother?
Great to see you.
How are you? it's good to see you, man. We were doing some tech stuff right up to the drop, and we got it all worked out. I guess the Geekscapes will be the judge of that. All right, and then let's have Connor in here. Connor Sekschulte. He is the graphic novelist who put out this this comic, Generous Bosom, which if y'all are fans of, if you know, who do you get compared to? I think artwork style, if you're a fan of big graphic novel publications like Blankets that have a really like nice strong pencil style to them and ink style to them, I think some of like Jeff Lemire's indie books are in there, and obviously I'm guessing that you could compare it to the big ones too. What would some of those big ones be, Connor? It's on the edge of my
You have to say them. I can't compare myself to the big ones here.
you can. I'm obviously thinking of like Ball and what's the one where the kids go in the woods and they end up like having sex with the STDs?
Oh yeah,
Black, like weird
Black Hole. You can probably see it on the show. That's the red book right there. Yeah, Black Hole.
And Black Hole is one of these movies that like, or one of these properties that they keep talking about. Oh, they're gonna make a Black Hole movie. Oh, they're gonna make a. It just never happened. But I mean, honestly, Connor, maybe we start talking to you because you're the originator of this material that turned into this movie, Ultrasound. What the heck? I think is ultimately what we got to I mean, you are an indie comics and graphic novelist. Mm-hmm. And like, do you even touch superhero books, or is that like, nah, man, I'm going to go play over in this wide field of other stuff and let the capes like do their own thing?
Generally, yeah, I would say that sort of describes my disposition towards it. Although, you know, I don't hold my nose at this stuff. I just, there's just so much that's great in the indie space that is what I'm, interested in. I think like, when I got super psyched about comics, like in my early teens or something like that, it was a lot of kind of on the cusp of like the mainstream and indie stuff. It was stuff like Bone or Scud, the Disposable Assassin, and stuff that. They were like,
you know, Rob
really got me into it. Yeah.
Rob, we shared a roster with Rob and I were on the same directing roster over at Rob's production company Lodger, that's responsible for Ultrasound and Geekscape. My partner who started Geekscape with me, George Callert, is Rob's cousin. George is my partner in Geekscape. Lodger, I always feel like is a bit of like the sister company that has the production arm, responsible for some of the videos we've made over the years, and also has helped us with films like Dock of the Dead, that Geekscape co-produced. So whenever I think of like the work that Rob, I put you all together, that George and Rob put do over at Lodger, whenever I think of the work y'all do over there, I do always think about us as like that roster. And there was a window where, who's that dude, Billy Proveda over in Santa Monica, when we used to like collaborate with him? Do you remember that, Rob?
No.
Billy Proveda was that dude in Santa Monica who would help us on like with like super music video pitches and stuff like that. The British guy.
Okay.
You don't remember that dude?
No, I remember.
He's a good dude. He had his own roster of directors.
Uh-huh.
And we had our roster of directors. Right? Because Adam Mortimer was on the show like a year and a half ago with his film.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We love Adam.
Ben Barnes.
We love you. Ben Barnes. When Billy Proveda's had the Scud creator as a director on his roster.
Rob Schraub.
Yeah, Rob Schraub, who like did all, who are the guys in Santa Monica that do all the weird films, like short films? Way to research this stuff, Jonathan. I didn't know we were going to be talking about Rob Schraub like going into.
Are you talking
this,
about like the, is it like the Starburns stuff? Is that what you're thinking?
The Starburns guys, all those Starburns dudes who we all know because literally they share the booth next to us. And like all these huge cartoonists and comedians have come out of Starburns and are still over at Starburns. That all came out of like that Film 101 or TV 108. Channel 101.
Yeah, yeah.
And Rob was part of that whole group.
Yeah, yeah.
With those guys. Did you not know any of this stuff, Rob? Totally. That was like when I went over to Santa Monica and met with Billy and I'd gone through the roster. And Rob Schraub, because I'm like you, Connor, I was like a big fan of the indie stuff like Bone, like Madman.
Yeah.
I would love to still make a Concrete film out of Paul Chadwick's Concrete. I don't need to buy it, but I was in the comic store last week and I saw an enormous collection of Concrete issues. And I was like, we should buy this. No, dude, you've bought these things 10 times over. Like,
yeah.
I think I'm like you. So, yeah, I did get really excited when we were on the same roster as Rob Schraub. Rob Schroeder, and that's the connection there. What else were you reading? Like, where did you grow up?
I grew up in central Pennsylvania, largely a little town called Lewisburg.
Okay,
it's
in the indie comic scene. Like, I mean, I imagine whatever their comic store is there, and I'm guessing in the 90s, like you're doing everything you can to avoid like just reading the Clone Saga, right? Like just Spider-Man books and X-Men books and stuff like that.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm realizing now that I have like more of an idea of what was going on in comics history when I like got into it. But it was like I was just getting psyched on comics just after the big sort of like bust had happened in the 90s. And so, yeah, I had to drive an hour to get to the nearest comic shop. And it was like a big deal. You know, we would drive to State College, PA, where Penn State is and everything.
We'd
go to the comic swap there in State College. That was my spot.
Matt Kelly, who runs the podcast network, he went to. He's a Penn State graduate.
Oh man, I'm sure he's familiar with the comic tons swap.
Of stories. He might be. So you're into these indie books. What are the ones that are popping off the shelves? You mentioned like Scud. I mean, you had to have loved Daniel Klaus and that stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, and I would say probably Velvet Glove, Cast in Iron is a definite influence on this material for sure. Like the kind of strange, psychological, surreal stuff.
And did you go to school for art? Was this something that you were studying? When did you start drawing?
I drew, all through my life, and then I went to art school for undergrad. I actually have a degree in painting, but it was in like undergraduate art school that I got into making comics. I found a sort of crew of friends where we all wanted to make comics together, and we started self-publishing zines, and it was kind of all over from there. I went to the Maryland Institute College of Arts. We were really close to Bethesda, Maryland, where the Small Press Expo happens, and so we would go there every year, and that was my first kind of introduction into indie comics culture and self-publishing and all that stuff. And it was just it was all over once I got to visit SPX.
It's insane. I mean, as a comic book lover, the closest I've gotten was writing comics. You know, I've written comics here and there, off and on for different places, but I'm just not the artist. Like, even when I try and micromanage the artist with like the blocking of the panels and things like that, I realize that that's Jonathan, that's not your strong suit. Like, they are artists, let them be artists, and maybe something closer to a Marvel method where you throw a plot and let them do the breakdown. is a little better to the pacing of comics. But the pacing of comics is very, very different than the pacing of film, which is where Rob and I kind of came up in. We were always film guys, I'm guessing. Right, Rob? Is that accurate?
Yes.
But ever since I've known you, you've always been the dude who goes to, like, Secret Headquarters, I think is still, like, roughly your comic shop, right?
Yep.
Rob, like, you go to Secret Headquarters and you come back with, like, a graphic novel and you're like, hey, man, have you seen this? And even though I do like the indie comics and even though I do like the superhero comics and the big two and maybe Image and Dark Horse, you and I would always have a bit of a discourse about, like, what the most recent big indie is.
Yeah, even at,
so how did,
even at,
yeah, go ahead.
Like, we've been to many conventions together, and I know, yeah, like, at the end of the day, I'd go to your booth and be like, look at all the shit I got. I'm going to put it under your booth. Like, isn't this amazing? And you'd be like,
it's all good.
It's all good, dude. Like, pile of paper.
Well, we need the giveaways. Every now and then, Matt Kelly would accidentally give your comics away. I'm kidding. Yeah. He never did that. And you know what? I think we're coming back to Comic-Con this summer. I think the whole pandemic thing has a lot, like, I know they're rushing to put WonderCon together. You got an email today that's like, come, WonderCon badges are on sale. I think WonderCon's supposed to be like in a week. That's an exaggeration. Yeah. But I did apply for Comic-Con rooms for exhibitors. So
excellent. Yeah.
I think we're back this summer, knock on wood, that you will be able to put your indie comics back under the booth. But where did you discover this one, Generous Bosom? Like, because this didn't seem like something that hit the shelves before you started developing it that much. Did you have a prior, like, relationship with Connor? Were you just somebody who, like, on an indie scene was like, hey, there's this creator out in freaking Maryland that is doing some cool work, and I'm going to pick up his book before it hits shelves? Like, tell me about discovering this thing, Rob. No, dude,
you put your finger on it. I was at Secret Headquarters. I want to say it was 2015, and the first book was on the shelf, published by Breakdown Press in the UK. And I feel like it was recommended to me. But I read it and I was very intrigued, but didn't really know where it was headed. Then second book came out in 2016. And that's when I reached out to Connor to see what was up over there. Because
You've been looking for your first feature for, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think as an indie director doing the music video and commercials and producing, and I got to say, like, Rob is an Emmy award winning director. Like, he directs the Actors on Access stuff. You work with some of the biggest actors in the world, especially for that series, right? Like,
yeah,
and you've done music videos for, like, Weezer and this and that, we've seen you make some amazing videos, but we've always been on the hunt for that first feature. We've watched Adam do his features. We've watched some of the other directors that we've come up with do their first features, but you've always been in the hunt, scouring good material for your first feature.
Yeah.
Why and this one?
Yeah, I do enjoy producing too. And I did a lot of producing on this one. And then we had made a couple other films, Sunchoke, Uncle Kent 2. So, you know, it's always been kind of my passion to tell stories on a big screen. But yeah, this was the one that I guess checked all the boxes.
Well, I mean, having seen the graphic novel series that Connor did and having seen the movie, the translation between the two is that you did not take as many liberties as I see a lot of comic book adaptations take. Is that because Connor wrote the script? Is that because, like, how close were you in taking this material from, like, Connor's pages onto the screen? I mean, and do you agree with that assessment, Rob? Because I'm seeing pieces of dialogue that are similar. I'm seeing framing that is similar, and I'm seeing pacing and back and forths, even in the singles and things like that, that are similar.
Yeah, that's very interesting, because I put down the books, because there were two books when we got going on the script.
There were three when we were filming.
But there, and there are sequences in three that do make it into the film, but temporally and structurally they are in different places than they are in the graphic novel.
Yeah, Connor can talk more about that process, because he wrote the screenplay after two.
So he could cheat.
It was like a cheat.
Yeah, he could cheat.
He cheated.
Yeah, he could be like, oh, I know what's going to happen, so I'll just put it in the script. You could George R. R. Martin the whole motherfucker.
Yeah, sort of did. Although I actually, because has George put out the last book yet?
No, yeah, so he doesn't have to. He's playing Elden Ring. He's not doing that.
I got one up on him, but yeah, I actually did release the last book. But yeah, the movie we had finished it, and the movie was out. Yeah, before the last book was out.
What is that like? Because again, like I said, like I'm thinking about that swimming sequence that is early in the film, but it's not until book three.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about, like, are those, like, talk to me about this, Connor, because are those I don't want to say course corrections, because each piece is a piece in and of itself. If you're a fan of the graphic novel series, that's a graphic novel series, the film is the film, right? But, like, what adjustments are you making narratively, creatively, in consciously taking this material from page to screen? And did you inform book four in having written the full story in the screenplay?
Definitely. Yeah. The last two, book three and book four were both done with basically a finished screenplay at that point. So I like wrote and drew the first two books and then wrote the script and then made the third and fourth book kind of like from the script. So like the first bit of the screenplay was based on the comic and then the last bit of the comic is sort of based on the screenplay. You know, sort of like a weird spiral.
How do you keep track of that?
It was tough, and definitely like it was good. Rob mentioned like he put down the books at a certain point because we just had to, because there were so many different avenues and little details and stuff that we had, you know, there was like the stuff we had talked about, the stuff that we talked about that was in the script, the stuff that we had talked about that wasn't in the script, the stuff that's in the comic but not in the script, something's in the script that's not in the comic, and it would just get like super confusing. But Yeah, it was confusing.
and Rob, why put down the comic is the next question I have for you. Why not continue to, because the comic is pretty economic in its structure. Like it's pretty like it. Does that make sense? Like when you look at something like Blankets, which is a pretty beautiful indie book, like it does go into these visual flourishes, but I think there's a mathematical approach. Can I say that, Connor? There's almost like a, not geometric, but like an architectural approach to your artwork where where things like having not just a structure, but like a mirror image or you know what I'm saying? Like it's a structure. You have a very strict structure to what you're laying out almost in an architectural fashion. Why not use that further up? And well, this is not a, like you did it wrong, you did it right. Like I'm just asking like what your process is.
Well, you know, when Connor wrote the script, he had the two books, the potential to write a 250 page script was there.
Yeah.
And we didn't want that to happen because I knew there was no chance of ever getting that made. So immediately from day one, we started with a page count. Like we got to get closer to 100 than 140. And then, started making the adjustments to make sure that the page count was something reasonable that we could shoot, you know, on an indie budget and in a short number of days. So
did you have to cut the sex scenes?
We didn't have to.
I don't want to dissuade anybody from watching the film, but if you're a fan of Connor's material, and you're like, man, I can't wait to see those sex scenes on screen. Because let's face it, when you were 12, that's what got you into some of those comic book stores. And that's definitely what got you to pick up 8-Ball. Some of those scenes are not in the finished film. Did you film some of those scenes? Were there scenes that, like, when it got to editing? Because I feel like, maybe I'm doing the worst effing job of saying, of like asking these kind of questions, but I feel like, and I think what I'm really kind of obsessed with is the multiple revisions, because editing is yet another one. Mm-hmm. And that's why I ask, like, did you shoot that stuff? And the sex scene is just a joke, but I'm talking about just any of the scenes. Did you shoot that stuff and then have to lose it in editing? Because again, y'all were doing post. Y'all literally wrapped this movie the week before the shutdown. I remember the day you wrapped this film.
We
shot some more. There was more sex scene, but it wasn't as graphic as what's in the book. And then there was some other really funny stuff. Some that we shot, some that we didn't, that kind of kept us on track, but we didn't shoot a ton of stuff that didn't make it in. We shot the whole film in 19 days.
Wow.
And we pretty much used, you know, almost everything. So.
And Connor, watching the film, and I know you wrote the script for it, but watching the film, how does it, like, how does it compare, and how does it feel knowing the seed of this thing and then seeing it in a different iteration through the eyes of a different creator, even if you might have had a very close creative relationship?
Yeah, it's a wild thing. It's super strange because the originating story like comes from a very personal place, and like just the relationship you have with a story as you're, you know, it took me like close to 10 years to draw the whole thing. So, I'm like very, very close to the material, but even starting with like writing the screenplay, I started to get an inkling of like, oh, this is a totally different art form. Like, you know, just the page count thing was like, if I put in every like little bit of detail and stage direction that I'm able to do as a cartoonist into the screenplay, like it's going to be a 500 page screenplay. And so it was early in the process that I was like, oh, I have to leave space for other artists to take this material on and make their own decisions with it. And so, yeah, I mean, it's both a sort of like painful, but then really beautiful and amazing process where it's like this thing that is very specifically yours then becomes this collaborative art piece in this really beautiful way, and yeah, it's just really cool to see it. It's like a totally different work of art that I never ever could have made on my own and would never exist without, like, you know, dozens and dozens of people, and so yeah, it's wild. And
I whenever I'm describing that relationship that an audience has with art, I like to call it the 1+1=3.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it's like you have this singular vision, right? Of like, you got Rob's singular vision as the filmmaker. You've got your singular vision as the originator of the material and the comic creator, graphic novelist. I don't know if how you stand on the whole comic book version.
You can call it a comic. Call it a comic. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So you got this. Some people are like, hey.
If it's the difference between me getting a grant and not getting a grant, call it a graphic novel.
Yeah, sure.
Otherwise, it's a comic, you know.
So you have these, you know, you have the singular vision here, the singular vision here. But yes, I think what you said is appropriate. You leave the room, and I think like Rob's job or the filmmaker's job is then an extension of that. It's not over discipline the frame or the story. So because there's a third person in that dance, the audience, that you Absolutely. Have to leave an appropriate amount of space and information for. So you can't just come out guns blazing and go, this is what the movie is, this is what the script is, have a character explain everything, have the thing just railroaded story-wise and plot-wise at your audience. You have to literally just give them the time to do the emotional math to relate to the material, to step back from the painting, or to reflect on the song, right? Think about the spaces between tracks, or sit with a book, turn the chapters, right? Like, you have to have that time. And so now we've got the 1+1=3, but we've got Connor's contribution, Rob's contribution, and then ultimately the audience's contribution. But Connor, you said that this is a kind of a biographical or personal project. It's a weird film. This is a film about a guy who gets two flat tires on the road one night during a storm. He goes for shelter at a nearby house. He's invited to the house. He's probably drugged, but then the guy who owns the house propositions him to spend the night, not on the couch. Why don't you just share the bed with my wife, my young wife? You just go spend the night with my young wife. Vincent Kartheiser, who you know from Mad Men, is in the film. And he plays this guy who's kind of taken a weirdest shelter of his life here in this house. What was the origin of this? Because you did call it a personal project, but it is a little weird.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's not a directly autobiographical or anything like that.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Okay, you got me. You got me. You're good. You're good, John.
Spoilers.
This is a simulation, Connor. You're a rat in our maze now. Welcome to Geekscape. You're trapped in here with all the listeners, or what's left of them if I keep going on these diatribes. Yeah, what was this event or series of events or your upbringing that led to something like this?
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff. I think like the two major ones that spring to mind when folks ask about that is like, when I was in high school, I saw a hypnotist perform like at the like. I think it was either homecoming or prom at our high school, and I saw like friends of mine get hypnotized and do things, you know, that they would never have normally done especially in front of an audience of people, and even like they had suggestions that were like planted in their heads that then I talked about it later, and like, you know, things would
be like maturing. Animated a little bit, like
yeah, like the
words. Years later, you would say something, and then suddenly have this recollection.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I was gonna say, I don't want to like spoil anything, but there's a bit about like a ticket at that sort of towards the end of our film, and
sure.
the thing about like someone hiding a winning lottery ticket, and then somebody asking them where it was. I did that to a friend of mine. Like the hypnotist was like, "You have a winning lottery ticket, hide it someplace." And after the show was over, you know, it was like 20 minutes after they were all like awake and fine, I went up to my friend and I said, "Hey, where's your lottery ticket?" And this like glazed expression went over his face, and he like went to reach for where he had hidden his ticket, and he pulled it out, and he was like, "Wait, what? How did you know about that?" And was just like, had this like just the indescribable kind of expression on his face of like confusion and kind of fear. And it was so strange and uncanny. Yeah.
You don't think that stuff is a bunch of ballyhoo?
Oh, no, I don't.
Like,
no.
You really believe in all that. What did I watch? I watched the Nightmare Alley with the Guillermo del Toro movie. Have you seen that one, Rob? That's the one that where Bradley Cooper kind of like goes in with a circus, and he learns the tricks of basically conning people as a hypnotist. And then it flash forwards a couple of years, and he and Rooney Mara are now in New York, and they're doing the hypnotist thing. And they get wrapped up like being con, like he's a con artist, right? Like he's using tricks to act like he's a hypnotist, not a hypnotist, but a clairvoyant. He's using like personal takes and tricks that he learned from David Strathairn back in the circus to like basically scam people. And he's in the scam is he's going to get his comeuppance. And you sense that the whole time you're watching the movie, you're like, someone's going to figure out that this guy's a fake. And he's going to find himself in a very uncomfortable situation because it's Guillermo del Toro, and characters don't have pleasant experiences in his movies.
Yeah, yeah.
but that Bradley Cooper character is a con artist. Like when you watch this stuff, like this whole almost like second reality or like third eye thing, like you believe that the hypnosis thing.
Yeah, yeah, I believe people.
Did you believe it before that, or was this the convincing factor?
I think I probably would have believed it before then, but then definitely seeing that performance for sure convinced me. Yeah.
And did you seek this material out afterwards, or you're like, holy crap, this is real? Did you become like an aficionado of this stuff? Did you seek out more instances where you could challenge this newfound belief in the like, I don't even know what to call it. Like the, what would you call this? Like the surreality? I don't know what you'd call this, you know, but this ability for people to hypnotize people. Did you want to go under hypnosis yourself?
Ooh, no, I've never sought that out myself.
That's why he's a comic book creator. He's like, the story is mine. Like, listen, Rob, you can go off and make your little four color funny all you want, but this story is mine. I'm going to control it. And hell no, you're never going to hypnotize
yeah.
me. I got to have my feet on the ground every sure. moment of the day. Or is that, are you like that, Connor? Are you a bit like, this is how it's got to be? Not in a bad way, but just in a confident way.
Like in terms of the, are you talking like creatively in terms of the.
Personally, storytelling style, like, is that, do you find yourself, and I'm talking about myself as well. Like, I don't drink alcohol. Da da da. Like, do you find yourself wanting, like, an amount of control over any given situation or in your storytelling or in your collaborations with others?
Somewhat, although I would say, like, probably among my cartoonist friends, I'm probably, I think that I'm probably a more collaborative person than some folks that I'm, you know, friends with and that I know, but
sure.
I don't know, maybe yeah. that might be a better question for Rob, because I don't know how...
yeah, Rob, was Connor a pain in the ass?
No, you know, I think pretty early on, we both realized that, you know, we were along for a ride. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we certainly, both of us certainly exhibited as much, you know, control as we could. But when you're making, you know, a low budget movie too, you're also sort of at the mercy of the locations that you can find and afford, or, you know, mm-hmm. the number of days you have. So you can't do the complicated shot that you thought was the most important thing in the world.
So did that affect Connor's script? Were there times when you would go back and be like, hey, Connor, like, I know this is a big part of the story, or I mean, no big part of the story. The story's complete.
There were a couple mm-hmm. little ones. There was a scene, like, Connor wrote some really small but important scenes, and some of them, you know, would take place like a 30-second scene at a grocery store, and there was a baby, for example. It's like, we can get a grocery That's store book, yeah. with a baby and a bunch of extras, but something else has to go. So
it's a company move.
It's a company move. So even though it's a quick thing, it's half a day. We don't have, you know, half a day for 30 seconds is better be really, really important. So, you know, there's a lot of that. I feel like, you know, with our music videos that we've done together over the years, and, you know, with this, it's about priorities. So there's always like, what's the most important thing for day? And, you know, you just have to make constant sacrifices. So,
And for you, Rob, like, what connected you to the material? Cause like, I mean, I talked to Connor, and Connor said that this experience with the psychic started him down the road to this, because I mean, watching this, the Vincent Kartheiser character, the one Vincent plays, start to find himself throughout as the film goes on, like, not being in control of the situation and finding himself in a spiraling series of events. I'm super psychoanalyzing Connor at that point. And I'm like, oh, this dude, whew, red flags, control freak. No, I'm kidding. if that's what it was, I mean, just this, I can see how it spurs your creativity, and I'm being silly, but in all honesty, I can see how that kind of event would spur a creator's what if, like, whoa, what if, oh, and then this happens, and there's the domino effect that leads me through a story that's going to take me years to do. Like, it takes you time to make these graphic novels. For you, what was the thing that connected? I know that we're all always hunting for material. For you, what was the one that was like, this is it, I'm going to send the email, I'm going to make the phone call?
I mean, I certainly can't take credit for this sentiment, but
nobody's going to test you.
But adapting material, feel like a lot of it is about the experience that you have when you're introduced to it. So you read the book, and then if you find, like, your reaction is sort of your guide for adapting it. So you read the book and you're terrified, then you hope to make a terrifying movie. Mm-hmm. And you can rely on that experience of reading it in a way that you couldn't if you wrote it yourself. So that was it. Like, the confusion at the beginning, you know, it wasn't the whole story. So when I had read the first book and then the second book, I was intrigued, and I had this, you know, unsettled feeling of shifting reality. And, you know, the story is nested and there's a lot going on. So that I found very exciting. And then there was the practicality of it that, you know, I sensed that this might be doable, you know, like, I might be able to get this thing made. You know, we don't have too many grocery stores with babies and a bunch of shoppers. Wow. It's stuff that, you know, we could probably put together.
Yeah. And I imagine, and let me see if I can find some of the artwork here. For those of you all watching the stream on YouTube or Facebook or Twitch, let me see if we can find some of the artwork I've got here of
the graphic novel. Here's Generous Bosom for y'all. And just looking at the artwork, and I know I'm streaming through it pretty quick here on the screen. Some of this stuff is just people talking in locations. You know, you have, and you do have a lot of the shots. Like, Connor, is filmmaking something that you had interest in, or is this language that you picked up as a comic book artist? Because we're looking at a traditional over shoulder, you know, doubles coverage kind of stuff. And if I'm reading this in the comic shop, I think I'm thinking what Rob's thinking. I'm like, this guy has a film eye. This is paced like a film. And at the end of the day, people talking, I can afford that. This might be the one that I make into a film. Was that, were you cognizant of that kind of stuff as you were making it, or was it always just going to be a series of comics?
Yeah, I think that it's hard to like fully go all the way back to what I thought. I mean, I've always had an interest in film for sure, and I feel like always, you know, when I'm working on comics, I feel like they're in conversation with films, and movies I see like inform the way I make visual and storytelling decisions 100%. But I think that, yeah, my ambition at the start of this book was that it would be a comic book, you know, and that it would be like a big, long, sprawling comic book, but a comic book. Sure. Yeah.
And who are some of the creators working now that you still like aspire to or get influenced by?
There's a ton. Man,
like if somebody's listening right now and they're mm-hmm. like, hey, you know what, it's Comic Book Wednesday in a day, let me go pick up that one that Connor suggested, what would something like that be if they really wanted to step away from the capes?
The people that have had the hugest influence on me have been like the peers that I came up with at the Maryland Institute College of Art. And a lot of them are still making comics. Like my friend Lane Milburn just put out an amazing sci-fi graphic novel with Fantagraphics this past year called Lure that is mm-hmm. amazing. And I think would appeal to folks that are into more like sort of traditional comics because it's beautifully drawn. It's in full color. And it's really informed by like sci-fi literature. I'm thinking like a lot of my friends and peers, but I think that I don't know. I'm biased.
You can shout out your peers. Yeah. Cause I mean, Fantagraphics is not a small publishing company in indie space. Like Fantagraphics also has a booth at Comic-Con. We should have your friend at the Geekscape booth this summer.
Heck, if
he's in San Diego, we should have him signing at the booth, telling people about Lure. I mean, the reason I think I started this show way back when was because we're not at this crazy like place that we are now as geeks where this stuff is so accessible and everybody knows about the Z-list Marvel characters. I don't think most of us had this level of collaboration or access 15 years ago when this started. You know, now I think people, for instance, if you wanted fantasy 15 years ago, you had Lord of the Rings and Harry Potter. Now there's, you have like people talking about Wheel of Time and stuff that like I hadn't even thought about that stuff since high school, mm-hmm. right? Middle school. And now there's like Dragonlance. Now there's tabletop. So if you're talking about fantasy, you're not just talking about Lord of the Rings anymore. You're talking about tabletop. You're talking about Elden Ring and Dark Souls. When you talk about just video games, you're dicing up the pie even further. There have been so many niches here that like, how do you find some of this stuff? I think this is absolutely the place where I would want you to recommend stuff to the listeners.
Connor has a Fantagraphics book coming out soon too.
Good, because his ass is going to sign at our booth too this summer.
Heck yeah!
Put a stamp on that one.
Yeah, we're collecting the all of the Generous Bosom books under the name Ultrasound. It's going to come out with Fantagraphics. Should be May, we're thinking, but yeah.
Now a spectacular big spectacle Hollywood film that's going to be up there in the big top, right? You're going to have that by Rob Schroeder.
Yeah.
You're going to write the foreword to that, Rob?
No.
Connor's going to ask one of his graphic novelist's buddies to do it.
There's no forward. But
just put the movie poster on the cover. You know that, like when that happens, when you like you read like one of those adaptations. You know what I saw? There's a video game called Dante's Inferno. And they republished the classic
Dante's Inferno, and they said the basis for the popular video game of the same name, in the cover of Dante's Inferno, the amazing classic literature,
yeah,
had the cover from the video game on it.
That's perfect.
And that's what they were putting out in freaking Barnes and Nobles and on
Amazon. That's a savvy operator, though, because you know the Inferno, the Divine Comedy is like public domain, so they just have to... Yes. Yeah.
You got anything these gamers are going to want to read?
Yeah,
these gamers are into the Game of Thrones. We got anything like Game of Thrones?
Yeah.
We could just go
to the public to throw domain.
It's like, when I saw that, when I saw the video game cover to Dante's Inferno on the Divine Comedy, I was like,
"That's amazing.
We're spiraling the drain culturally." Like this, that's what you got to do. You got to take the comic. You've already changed the name. You got to take it and put Vincent Kartheiser's picture like right there on the front. Come on,
Connor. Connor did make a new cover that's really nice.
Yeah,
it does it have the stars of the film in it?
It does not. I actually have the original artwork right here. I can show it to you.
Do you want to toil and as a come on, man, sell out, Connor?
this is roughly what the cover for the
let me see
the book.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah,
that is pretty cool. I still need you to sell out, Connor.
All right, I'm working on it,
Connor. That's what you do. You know what? F it. Put Ben Affleck on the cover.
Why not?
What's he gonna do? Yeah. You know, say this is what you do. This is what you do. Put The Rock on the cover.
Let's see how many issues.
Let's see.
Here's what you do.
You want to sell some books? This is what you do. Put Harry Potter on the cover, fighting The Rock. This is what you do. And Rob, you just, you know, don't worry. When they discover the book, they're gonna find the movie. All right, they're gonna be like, wow, this looks pretty tight, but I don't want to read. I'm gonna go over here to the VOD, and I'm gonna go look for this Harry Potter versus the Rock movie.
Yeah,
and I'm gonna watch that. And just don't tell them. I mean, listen, they're gonna be watching this movie, and the movie's weird. Like the movie's psychological, and it's weird, and it's trippy. They're gonna be watching this movie. They're not gonna know when the Rock and Harry Potter are gonna fight. They're gonna get to the end credits. Listen, the whole movie's gonna end, and they're gonna be like,
What
the fuck did I just watch? Did The Rock fight Harry Potter in that? I don't feel like I was lied to or tricked. So, yeah, that was pretty tight. That's what you got to do. All Marketing right. 101.
All right. We'll get the PR people on the phone.
Listen, this is why I'm doing a podcast in my
office. We'll wake them up.
Don't listen to me. Don't listen to me. That cover looked horrifically beautiful. Like, it looked like it was... It does. It looked like what I felt when I watched the movie. It looked like somebody whose identity was put into question, and there was a multifaceted sort of. Yeah, does that make sense? Like that piece of art looked great, looked amazing. Do you ever write for other people? I know this is a film, but as far as your graphic novelist, do you ever let other artists jam on your scripts, or is it pretty much like, hey, this is how it came out of my head as far as I heard it, script form? I think I know how this should look. Have you trusted other graphic novels to take your words and run with them?
I've done it a little bit, only like twice, but I really, really liked it. I really enjoyed that process, and I would definitely do it again. But yeah, it's just sort of like a practical thing. It's like the folks that I know who I want to like draw the stuff I know are busy with their own projects, and I don't have money on hand to like pay them to draw stuff. So it's a lot more practical to just draw my own material.
No, and in Geekscape, it's like, even if you're working for DC and Marvel, you're not making money in comics. Like money in comics is really, really tough to do. Like, it's you got to really do tough. Some Robert Kirkman level, adaptation of TV stuff. Mm-hmm. And then you got to have like a fleet of other writers making properties for your publishing company. So, don't think that like, oh, this person works in comics and it got turned into a movie. Don't think that is, you know, let's bring on the big bucks. Like, that is a grind, and you really got to love it. And absolutely, Connor, like, yeah, you love it. You loved writing the comics. What about screenwriting? Is this something that, like, the next words that you put on paper, does it have to turn into a comic, or are you going to continue to kind of work on screenplays? Was this the first screenplay that you wrote?
This was the first screenplay that I wrote, yeah.
Rob, why did you trust him with the screenplay?
Yeah, for real.
I'm kidding. He wouldn't have given it to me otherwise.
Is that true, Connor? No. When y'all are, I mean, first off, like, you, what'd you do? Send an email to Connor and be like,
I emailed him, and then he didn't write back. And then I think I emailed him again, and just, you know, followed up, said, hey, what's up? And then we started talking about it, and I think right out of from the very beginning, one, I was very impressed that Connor understood the rest of the story. So it wasn't just the two books. He could explain to me all four books where the story was headed. And he's just said he really wanted to write the screenplay or take a crack at it. So,
but there was no chance, Rob, like, because I mean, he did a good job with the screenplay, but was there ever, as you're waiting for those pages to come in, were you like, what if this isn't a storyteller that can transfer to this medium? Cause like I said, like the pacing's different. There's a lot of different discipline that you got to put into. I think there's a lot of trust you put into a script where it's like, no, you got to peel back and only let it be a blueprint, that kind of stuff, and leave space.
I mean,
was there any chance that you were going to have to just find just like some way to course correct?
If it Connor's probably, script? You know, could have died on the vine. Hmm. But also, you know, there is the business side of optioning material and making things, and you never know what's going to happen. So, you know, we did everything above board with, you know, a proper option and contract and agreement and all that stuff. So, you know, we both knew that, you know, what if Robert Kirkman buys this or wants to make this into a TV series and I'm not directing and you're not writing, and you know, that could have happened. So I think we were prepared for anything, but the hope was that the screenplay would be good and we'd make an indie movie. So.
And were you ever finding places in your, as your first screenwriting gig, Connor, were you ever finding places where maybe you knew the story and how it would be told with your pen or with your pencils, but when you got to the empty space where there are no visuals on the screenplay page, mm-hmm. did you ever feel like, oh shit, I just jumped out of a plane without a parachute. I don't know how to steer this towards what I'm the story that I know, but it's veering into another place for film. And how do I maybe course correct, get it back there? Or how do I, like, where did you pull your confidence from in kind of sticking the landing on this?
Yeah, I think there were definitely times, yeah, especially when I left kind of like adapting from the pages I'd drawn and already written and had secure, and went into like the territory where I hadn't drawn anything yet.
It's like a new organism now.
Yeah, and it's sort of like the section of the story that required a lot of like attention to detail, kind of the latter portion where we're having to do stuff like track like who's holding a given like ID card or like mm-hmm. where's this like note that someone got handed and things like that.
But you don't have the luxury like Rob did of leaving the pages behind. Like Rob mm-hmm. had the luxury of being like, okay, like my responsibility is the film. Right. I'm just going to do the film. You have the responsibility of both delivering and finishing the graphic novel series and finishing this movie. So you do have to have a two plates spinning at the same time.
Yeah.
Keeping them kind of like thematically similar, but organically like the material has to be kind of different at the same time. Yeah. Does that make sense?
Yeah. 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 And this maybe goes back to, I feel like I didn't fully answer a question you asked like a long time ago about like,
it was probably a crap question. Don't worry about it.
No, it was good. It was good. About like adapting stuff and like the swimming pool scene appearing
sure.
sooner and stuff. Yeah. It was actually really fun for me to be able to like work on this material that I'd been working on for a couple of years at that point and be like, oh, everything's wide open again. Everything is in play again. Cause I've been like serially publishing the comics. And so it was like, okay, well that's set in stone. Cause I've already published that. People have read it. I can't go back and like change those events. Like that's locked in. I have to like, the only thing that's like formable is what's the future in the story. But all of a sudden with the screenplay, like everything was in play. So that was actually really fun and liberating. And I could go back and like, if I decided to zig, you know, in the third act, I could go back to the first act and, you know, lay the track for that or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you could plant the seed to a tree that you actually thought you wanted to, that you actually needed to grow sooner.
Yeah, yeah.
I think that that is what people like Robert Kirkman have done, mm-hmm. or in The Walking Dead. I think that that's definitely something we've all witnessed George R. R. Martin do mm-hmm. in the adaptation of Game of Thrones. There's like, we all watched him kind of course correct things in the stories as it made itself to screen.
Yeah,
And then when they ran out of the running room of the books, I feel like, I don't want to say, you know, I feel like we all kind of felt when they ran out of running room that had been established in the novels.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we all kind of felt
the foundation kind of wasn't there in the later Game of Thrones series for where these relationships were going.
Hey, George, yeah, do you have any notebooks or anything?
Well, this was, how are we supposed to end this thing? And I mean, we'll see what they do with the Game of Thrones prequels and this and that. There are some people who enjoyed the Game of Thrones series and how it ended and stuff. And like, I think the same thing goes with like Lost. I think that the idea with Lost, and we've seen those creators go on to do some amazing stuff. And they're, it's crazy. Like, people are starting to watch Lost for the first time because they were born in the early thousands, and Lost was it's insane. I'm seeing that a lot on Twitter and places like that, where people are like, oh, I started watching Lost, the show, from when I was a child. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, cool. I'm going to walk into traffic. And they're discovering it for the first time, and they don't really know that it's going to end the way we all know that it ended. And when you listen to the creators talk, they were like, hey, we just wanted to do three seasons, and we knew how mm-hmm. that those three seasons looked. But ABC was like, we got a hit on our hands. We're chaining you to this desk, and you ain't ending us at three seasons. And I feel like that was the binge show before binge shows.
Yeah, yeah.
Because clearly, like, it gave birth to Hulu, in that Apple, or I'm sorry, ABC and iTunes, when you were able to like put the show out that everybody was talking about at the water cooler, they could just go to iTunes and get it. Mm-hmm. And Fox and CBS just kind of like watch that happen and be like, oh my God, iTunes is making so much money in this exclusive with ABC because of Lost. So they formed Hulu. It's kind of crazy that Hulu is now part of Disney ABC. But that being said, now that things can be the form they're supposed to be, mm-hmm. I feel like Lost Today would be a much different show. I think Lost Today would be that three season show mm-hmm. with a sequel and a prequel down the line, as we're seeing now. Mm-hmm. You had to do both at the same time. Course correct at two vehicles as you're driving two vehicles. This guy over here, he could be like,
well,
forget the funny books.
Well, not only did we forget the funny books, there was a moment when I handed, all this footage over to Brock Bodell, our editor. And I gave him the script and was like, here it is. This is, this is what we've got. And he had read the script before we shot.
Sure.
But I feel like he tossed it out the window too.
That was the next rewrite the editing.
Yeah. He was, he was like, I can make this different or better or fix some of the things you fucked up on set or whatever.
Were there things that you came to him and said, hey, listen, like, we had a rough day that day, and I don't know if we got everything, but I need this to really work into the next sequence. I need to marry these sequences, but that first sequence.
I think there were some sequences, John, you've seen the movie, so, mm-hmm. you know what I'm talking about. But there are some sequences where there's going to be intercutting, and you're going to cut from a flashback to modern day, to
but you're also hearing the score at that time, right?
To an hallucination,
right?
You
have your audio, but you're also listening to your audio, and you're thinking about thematic like glue that you can put in there, where you're like, okay, well, like, if this audio comes back, people are going to relate these disparate scenes because they hear that clicking, ticking sound again, or they hear,
yeah. Some of that was in the script, but when you get into editing, then that's when it really shines, where you can find the rhythms. And there's no reason to write that way. We know that we're going to be going back and forth. But then once, you start figuring out how it all comes together, you're rewriting, in the edit, I guess.
Did you ever read the script to Nightcrawler that they did? Do you remember Nightcrawler, the movie with Jake Gyllenhaal?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah.
Have you read that script?
No.
It has zero scene headings.
Oh, wow.
It's like you're just reading a montage sequence, and it's like, we're on Mulholland, dip down to the valley, smash through some streetlights, green turns red as his car zips through, takes a right onto Ventura, pulls up in front of a 7-Eleven, door to the 7-Eleven swings open. Meanwhile, across town, so-and-so steps into their office, and you're sitting there going, this is just a list of high energy shots. This isn't He's not like Tony Gilroy's not stopping to give you scene headings.
And he also wrote and directed.
And it feels like editing when you're watching it. It feels like that energy. I think if you all Google, if you're listening to this and Google the Nightcrawler screenplay,
I think
you'll see what I'm talking about. It's just pure energy, and I love it. And then you've got, I remember reading the Rushmore screenplay when that was going around and I was interning and people were like, oh, this movie, Rushmore is the next, or maybe it was Royal Tenenbaums. It was like, oh, this is the one, the next one that Wes Anderson's going to do. And like, it felt like every couple pages, you just have one of Wes Anderson's like hand drawings and like stuff, or maybe like halfway down the page to be a hand drawing. I think those rules are all legitimate rules. I a friend of mine asked me the other day, he texted me and said, do you think a flash forward's a cop out? Supposedly he had a script where he couldn't tell, like the character wasn't like, you weren't investing in the character early. He wanted to show how the stakes play. He wanted to raise the stakes without changing the story. So the story had to like go forward temporarily they had to move forward, but he wanted to raise stakes with the sequence by flashing forward. And he said, do you think that's a cop out? And I just responded, I said, I don't think anything's a cop out. I hate those rules. I hate those rules where it's like, you got to do this by the first five pages. I hate the rules where it's like, you got to do this. I think that's a great way to make your movie look like every other person's movie.
Yeah, it's like, what are the movies that like abide by all those rules? They're like the ones that you don't remember.
Yeah, I think there's a couple story places in town that do those rules so well, you fall for them every time. And I'm very much talking about Disney animation. I'm very much talking about the animation in Sony animation. Like if you watch Encanto, if you watch the Pixar, if you even watch the live action Jungle Book that Jon Favreau did, you could basically just like to the minute, to the page, feel Save the Cat or one of those screenplay books that says, okay, by like the midpoint, you have to have this happen. By the time you want to break into the third act, you got to have this happen. Like, to the page, those screenplay books, you know, key that stuff in.
Yeah.
I think if you're going to do that, if you're going to be the Hollywood screenplay writer, I think that's all good. I think it's a great way to do it, but you have to do it so well that you aren't speaking in someone else's language.
Yeah.
Down to the dialect. The other thing is, you know, be the president of the United States of America as a band and don't have all the strings on your guitar.
Yeah.
You remember those guys?
Yeah.
Like a three-string bass or like a weird-ass guitar, and they were just making sounds to make sounds. And I think that is the Tony Gilroy approach on Nightcrawler. It's like, you know what? Fuck scene headings. I don't have time for scene headings because my movie's not going to stop. Feel it in the film. I recommend you finding that because then when you're telling me Rob is getting into the edit, that's the last revision. That's the last rewrite.
Yeah.
You don't have to be a slave to that stuff. You can be like, oh, F it. You know that scene that we actually shot for the second act? I think it'll actually raise the stakes in the first act and bring the audience in. We need it there.
Yeah.
Boom. Now I just have to figure out with my sound person and my score how to thread it back into where it is now. Do you ever do that? Did you take large sections of the movie, Rob, and put them where they originally weren't planned to be?
Not initially. Like, we had an edit. The first edit was pretty close to the sequence and the script and, you know, page for page what happened. And there were just a couple instances where it was like, let's just mix it up. Let's see what we can come up with. And then, you know, there were those designed sequences where we knew in the script that we're jumping around. But until you actually start jumping around using your footage, you don't know exactly how it's going to go. But there's one interesting story that has come up.
And by that time, the things are colored and structured. Yeah. And you're like, well, I can't use that as a trick to marry these. Okay, tell me that story. I'm sorry.
Oh, it's come up a couple times. But one of the first conversations Connor and I had, I asked him which of those books he had read. Because I've read probably 10 of them. And
oh, I hate them.
I mean... There's a certain.
I don't hate them, and I'm lying. Like I do write to the sequence approach, which is like an even more further broken down version of Save the Cat.
Yeah.
But once I have the outline in my sequences, I erase them. Yeah, I erase the scene headings.
For me,
erase
it's always been headings, like,
and then I mix it up. Right. It's a good place. It's a good way to get a first draft.
Yeah, and for me, it had always been like, if you're going to break the rules, you need to know the rules.
Agreed.
So I'd read a bunch of them. Save the Cat. Robert McKee, all that stuff, you know, William Goldman. So I asked Connor which one he had read, and he hadn't read any of them. And I'd only asked.
Scott McCloud, making comics.
Yeah. I'd only ask so that we could even just have the language, you know, like, oh, you want to call it an inciting incident or a catalyst or a, you know, what are we going to, what?
Did he make you read those damn books?
No, he didn't read any of them.
I still haven't.
I would have quit right there, man.
No, there were no books and no, like, you know, we just made up our own words for what those things are that happen at the end of Act One.
Yeah. I think you do that regardless with your collaborators. You end up making words for stuff, just period. You're like, throw another one of those things on there. All right, folks, the movie is called Ultrasound. It's going to hit that VOD on March 11th. Okay, so you'll already have seen the Batman. You'll probably have already seen the Batman like 3 times. Okay, like
A week later,
how much romanticizing of nihilism do you actually want in your lives? Okay, like, do you really need this? A realistic take on a guy who dresses like a rodent and runs around punching clowns. Okay, we'll have fun with that. But having seen it 5 times, I have more homework for you. So riddle me this. What are you going to do March 11th? You're going to download this movie on your VOD, Ultrasound. You're going to watch it and you're going to be like, wow, that was a trippy ass movie. Now I know what these fools were talking about on the comic book show that I listened to, Geekscape. Connor, where can we follow you on these social media? I'm like burping. Where can I follow you on social media?
I'm on Instagram. My username is just as hard to spell as my last name is. But if you look me up, you can find it. It's Crepusculine on Instagram.
Listen, this is why you got to put the damn rock fighting Harry Potter on the cover of your damn comic, because the marketing here. I think
Matt Kelly is part of it. I don't understand.
And I won't be respected as an indie artist.
Flavors it, yeah.
Man, I don't know, man. I just want you to be able to, like, come on, man. We got to start selling you out hard.
Yeah.
Don't you want some of that Walking Dead money? Come on, man.
We're working on it.
Okay.
But we should say there's screenings in Chicago and in LA as well. If you want to come do it the old fashioned way,
is there a website for that?
We're playing at the Siskel. And I think everything should be on the Magnolia site, right, Ron?
Yeah.
Magnolia Pictures has that going on. If you go to Magnolia Pictures website, you can find out where Ultrasound is playing.
Yeah.
I like that distributor. They have this movie that they're also putting out with like the oil tankers like lighting up. There's like an earthquake underneath. Have you seen these disaster movies that come out of freaking like Norway or somewhere? It's like these are like foreign films. Magnolia's distributing it. They solicited it to Geekscape at the same time they solicited your film. And I was like, both these films look pretty badass. I think it's in Polish or something, but it did look cool. I was like, see, now that's a disaster movie. I don't know about this Moonfall, but that actually looked pretty good. Not that I didn't buy tickets to Moonfall. I just didn't see it because the projector broke, but otherwise I would have been right there with Moonfall. Okay. Magnolia Pictures website. You're gonna look for these because they're screening March 11th that weekend in Chicago, in Los Angeles. I know y'all are here. You're probably going to do a little Q&A afterwards, I'm guessing, Ron?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I'll be there in Chicago. Yep.
Okay, so you are going to lock that down. And then you can buy the comic where you can get these books.
Well, probably the best thing to do at this point is to pre-order it from Fantagraphics, pre-order the Ultrasound book, because the buying them individually, if you haven't been following along yet, it would be kind of expensive to jump in at this point. How much
would this be on eBay? What do you think? What you got here?
Well, I just found out that the third one just sold out, and they're probably not going to reprint that. So I don't know. People have been trying to hawk them for $100, something like that.
$100 a piece?
I've seen it.
That's amazing. That makes you feel good, though, right?
Not really. When it's like it could be.
You're like, I want people to read it.
Yeah. And I don't see. I only saw whatever a dollar from that anyway.
Right. Yeah.
God bless you. You know, no, it's good. It's good.
It hypes people up for your next one, though. I think is what it does. We're like, oh, this thing's gonna sell out.
They gotta buy it while it's hot. Yeah,
you're in the Harry Potter Fights the Rock movie, so I think you're gonna do that.
So look up fangraphics.com/Harry Potter vs. The Rock. Download the CBR file.
If you can figure out how to use CBR, not Amazon. No offense, CBR, but I know people weren't happy with that merger. Yeah. Oh no, was it? It was Comixology. Comixology is the one that merged with Amazon, and people were like, what the fuck just happened to my Comixology? Yeah, Rob, where can we find you?
I'm not very into social media, but I have an Instagram called Tashi Rob.
Okay. It's on there. I'm just telling you guys, like, listen, you're not leaving the marketing to George, are you?
Some of it.
The good God. Is that what Geekscape's here for? Is to pick
also Ultrasound Movie is on. Okay. On
Ultrasound Movie, yeah.
On Instagram. Ultrasound Movie on Instagram. Okay, let's do that.
I think it's on Geekscape all. I think it's on all the social medias.
Okay. Ultrasound Movie. All right, that's what you're going to look for. I got Rob Schroeder here. He's the director and the writer. Connor Sucholsky. I fucked that up hard.
You were doing good up until that last one, yeah.
Yeah. Sculty.
Steck no. Schulte.
Steck Schulte. Steck
Schulte. It. There you go, yeah.
Podcasting, so easy, an idiot can do it. And we do it every week. We're going to come up pretty soon here with our Batman reaction to Matt Reeves' new Batman. And I think I'm sitting down with one of the producers of Batman here in the next week. Literally in the next week, I'll be sitting down with them. I don't know if I'm live streaming that or going to the office and recording that remotely. I don't know how we're doing to Geekscape us, but the best way to find out is subscribe to us on whatever podcast platform you like. Subscribe to Geekscape. You'll enjoy it. And then when you're done listening to this show, I want you to go explore the rest of the Geekscape network we've so finely and carefully put together for you. We got all sorts of movies for all your pop culture needs, all sorts of podcasts for your pop culture needs. Go check those out. All right. That's enough. Jonathan's rambling. I love you. Until next time, Geekscapists, don't hate, create. We'll see y'all at Comic-Con. Peace.
Thanks so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Geekscape Network.